This week's episode of the Security Ledger podcast is brought to you by Code 42. Today's progressive, employee-focused, idea-rich organizations are looking for new and less restrictive ways to protect their data. Code 42 Next-Gen Data Loss Protection is a simpler, quicker way to secure an organization's endpoint and cloud data from loss, leak, misuse, and theft. You can check them out at code42.com. That's code, and then the numbers 42.com. This is the Security Ledger Podcast, and I'm Paul Roberts, Editor-in-Chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode number 137, we wrap up the RSA Security Conference with a discussion about data leak prevention, or DLP technologies. They've been around for years, but the networks that DLP was designed to protect have changed in the meantime. We speak with Vijay Ramanathan of the firm Code 42 about what next-gen data leak protection looks like. But first, if there was one theme that dominated the discussion of this year's RSA Security Conference in San Francisco, it was a shortage of cybersecurity professionals across industries. After all, cool security tools and services are great, but without any boots on the ground to run the tools or manage the services, they're not much good, are they? There were many proposed responses to this problem. Companies were talking more and more about managed security offerings. Artificial intelligence and machine learning were offered as a way to do more, or at least to do no less, with fewer people. But pretty much everyone agrees that the big fix for the cybersecurity skills shortage is simply to produce more information security professionals. Where will all those people come from? Well, according to our next guest, you may find them now going around your neighborhood door-to-door selling cookies. Elizabeth Joyce is the Chief Information Security Officer of the firm Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, or HPE. She joined me in the Security Ledger studios to talk about the program that Hewlett-Packard Enterprise has launched with the Girl Scouts to empower young girls with crucial cybersecurity skills and knowledge. Scouts participating in the program can earn a cybersecurity patch in recognition of their efforts. The collaboration is part of the Girl Scouts' push to reduce the gender gap in technology by bringing 2.5 million girls into the STEM, or science, technology, engineering, and math pipeline by 2025. The cybersecurity industry is a particularly egregious example of gender inequities, with only 11% of professionals in the field being women. In this conversation, Liz and I talk about the collaboration with Girl Scouts of America, as well as a bigger challenge of cultivating diversity in the cybersecurity industry.
Liz Joyce, I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for Hewlett-Packard Enterprise.
And Liz, welcome to Security Ledger Podcast.
Thanks, Paul. Glad to be here.
So we're here talking about a really interesting program that Hewlett-Packard Enterprise did with Girl Scouts of America. And this was around teaching young girls and young women cybersecurity skills. Talk just a little bit about this program and this Cyber Squad game that you guys designed.
Sure, I'd love to. So we just announced last month about a new cybersecurity curriculum, which is really geared at educating Girl Scouts on cybersecurity skills. We did this in partnership with Girl Scouts Nation's Capital, and they are the largest Girl Scouts council in the U.S. They got like 60,000 Girl Scouts and about 27,000 adult volunteers supporting them. And the curriculum really was targeted at the junior Girl Scouts. So that's ages 9 to 11. And the idea was, in this like super connected world that we live in these days, to teach girls about sort of online safety and how to defensively navigate the internet, because the internet is such a wonderful equalizing force, but we are so connected, and we know that we need to make sure that we help girls be able to leverage that and do so safely. And so in that program, you know, we covered four key domains around personal information and their digital footprint, online safety, about privacy and security, and the topic of cyberbullying. What's different about what we've done is we created an online educational game called Cyber Squad, as you mentioned. And we did that in conjunction with a games company, Romero Games, who won BAFTA awards for games that they have done previously, and really wanted to create this fun online experience and also teach them some of those basic skills that they need in our very connected world these days.
So how does this game work? Like, what do you do?
So when the girls go to log in, it's this sort of narrative role play format. And the main character is actually a female. So the girls can go in and design their avatar, and they become, you know, they control that character. And then they meet some friends there, Ashley and Camilla. And basically what happens is they get to experience several different storylines, which have lots of different scenarios. And these provide scenarios that they will come across, you know, at home or at school or when they're out. And through those, they experience some situations where they can make either a safe decision or a sort of a riskier online security decision. And that way they're able to get through or see the results of those behaviors and the impact on them and their friends, but obviously in a very safe environment. So there's four basic storylines, each of which reflects each of those four areas that we talked about that deal with online safety and bullying, et cetera. And really let them experience that in a safe way. And then as they move through the game in each of those storylines and make those choices, they're able to sort of earn stars. And if they hit 5 stars in a game, that allows them to earn a virtual cyber patch. So then as they work their way through the entire game and all 4 storylines, which covers all of the curriculum, they gain 4 virtual cyber patches. So at the end of that experience, they're able to sort of come back out to their troop, and they will, from Girl Scouts Nation's capital, then be able to earn their real world physical cybersecurity patch, which acknowledges that they have completed this and attained those basic skills.
So there's now a cybersecurity patch that you can earn as a Girl Scout, just like your other skill patches.
Yes, correct. So Girl Scouts Nation's capital, in fact, Girl Scouts have generally declared sort of a mission around ensuring that they bring over 2.5 million girls into the STEM pipeline by the year 2025. So this is part of their larger mission and program to allow more girls to move into and see the opportunities in a STEM area. So we've been really excited about it because for us, within our company, we have a really strong culture about community service and pro bono work. So this was all done as pro bono work by the women on my team, which is actually a group called the Women in Cybersecurity International. And they were able to formulate the curriculum. We found with Girl Scouts Nation's Capital that they had the same, obviously, passion around this topic, but also love the fact that we were trying to do something really different and fun with this interactive game. And so that it would really help the girls learn those cyber skills. And I think the other really important thing for us was, you know, in doing this learning about technology and through technology, it gives them confidence in dealing with those things. But we also hoped that with that confidence and with that fun, it would spark sort of curiosity and a sort of willingness to discover more about science. If it's about cyber, obviously that's wonderful. And I'd love to see them learn more. And we're going to provide that opportunity for them to learn more. But if it just sparks an interest in the platform that they're on science or engineering or mathematics, then that's a wonderful part of this. Because we do want to be able to encourage more girls into STEM.
We tend to focus on cyberbullying as the sort of big problem with technology. But as you point out, you know, privacy and information security are just as big an issue.
Absolutely. I think something we learned in this is kids become pretty, you know, literate and fluent and can use the words. But a real understanding of, for example, what your digital footprint is, and that when you go online, you can leave artifacts online. And being clear about that and understanding what that can mean. But additionally, also understanding and learning how to question things. So in some of our online safety area, we talk about phishing, for example, and we know that's just for everybody, every company, every individual. You know, phishing is almost part of everybody's daily lives at this stage. But how girls can, A, be aware of that, but then trying to, I guess, inspire and instill in them these sort of cyber detecting capabilities, show them what are the hints and things that they need to look at to make sure that, is this really from who I think it's from? And should I respond or, you know, Should I take some other type of action? While the cyberbullying component obviously is very important, I mean, the statistics that I've seen are quite frightening in one way, where 80% of kids experience some kind of cyberbullying, but only 25% say they know what to do about it. So clearly that was an important part of the curriculum for us. However, the fact that kids are online at such a young age, most kids have their first device at age 10, and most have some type of social media account at age 11. So really ensuring that the kids understand what it means about your digital footprint, about protecting your information, and about being willing to sort of query and question things, and not always take them at face value. But we wanted to make sure that we did this, obviously, in a fun and appropriate way, so that the girls would be able to protect themselves and still enjoy the benefits of being online and being connected.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We think about young people as being digital natives and super savvy with technology, but some of this data really shows that, you know, kids are kids and they're naive in some ways, or at least not super worldly. Only, you know, 52% allow location sharing on their phone. Only 61% use privacy settings. 30% have posted their phone number online. Only 44%, not even a majority, use a password to protect their mobile device.
Yeah. So some of the things that, you know, you and I and others might take for granted, it really is reinforcing some basics and fundamental skills. And we view this as, these are almost like fundamental life skills for kids these days. Just like as a parent, you do not send your kid out the front door without teaching them how to cross the street safely, or when they get in a car, you have to buckle, you know, your seatbelt. It really seems like an imperative that we need to educate kids and make sure that they're aware.
You're listening to the Security Ledger podcast. This week's podcast is being brought to you by Code 42. Today's progressive, employee-focused, idea-rich organizations are looking for new and less restrictive ways to protect their data. Code 42 Next-Gen Data Loss Protection is a simpler, quicker way to secure an organization's endpoint and cloud data from loss, leak, misuse, and theft. You can check them out at code42.com. That's code, and then the numbers 42.com. You talked about the work that you do to promote STEM and that Girl Scouts are doing to promote STEM, kind of beyond, this is sort of the first step, which is just being safe online, being smart about sharing your data and information and kind of savvy about, you know, the types of risky scenarios that exist online. But as they get older, what are some of the other things that Hewlett Packard Enterprise is doing to promote science, technology, engineering, math, particularly with young women?
Yeah, we do quite a bit in this area. I mean, the company has a history of and a strong culture around inclusion and diversity. And it really is a kind of the core of some of what we do. So we do it at multiple levels because we really believe it is very important to do that. First and foremost is the structures and programs that you have internally in order to, you know, hire and develop and retain the bright people, right? And ensure that you have a really diverse workforce, because If you don't, like, I honestly believe you're selling yourself short. If you don't make sure that you have a pool that is diverse and inclusive and pulls in all of those bright young minds, then you're not going to drive innovation and creativity, because you won't have all the perspectives and views that you need to truly drive innovation. So for us, that's been really important, that at one level, as you look and to hire and bring people on board, there's a real focus and a real thoughtfulness about how you do that to ensure that your pool is diverse. But secondly, as you develop people, you want to ensure that those who are leading the programs, that they have a path. But additionally, in leadership places, that you have that diversity of thought as well. And be that gender diversity or other underrepresented groups, you again want to make sure that you have that diversity there. So, you know, we know as a company, we do pretty well in that as a tech company, but we also know, you know, there's more work to do. So, for example, even in my group, cybersecurity, it's recognized that relative to the global workforce, females, for example, represent, and depends which research you look at, 20% of the workforce are female. And in some places, it will say 11%, but ultimately, it's pretty low. And within my team, I'm very proud of the fact that we have about 32% of our workforce is female, and 50% of my direct staff, so our leadership, is female. But in all things and always, it always has to be the best person for the job. But you have to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to have their name in the hat and to be part of that conversation. I would say, though, just as importantly is what you do externally and outside your company. So obviously there's things like the outreach that we're doing as part of our pro bono work with Girl Scouts, but we also have lots of relationships with different external organizations, like, for example, the National Center for Women in Information Technology or National Action Council for Minorities in Engineering. Because, again, you want more thought to look at the bigger problem and the bigger issue and make sure you're part of that solution. And additionally, you know, as you look at high school age, we have our Code Wars program that's aimed at those in high school and how we can expose them to STEM and, you know, coding and the engineering and the sciences. So I think you have to look at a sort of all-encompassing perspective, and you have to be focused on it and driven and committed to it at all times.
You said 50% of your reports, as you look across, you know, your team and the women that you work alongside, any common themes or that jump out when you think about their path to the cybersecurity industry that might be suggestive of the way forward, you know, for the broader population? Any common themes emerge?
Yeah, I think in, you know, most people's cases, one, there's just a love and a passion of science and technology, right? That everybody has that in common at the start. But I really do believe those outreach programs make a real difference. I know from those who've either come in through interim programs or come on board, oftentimes it was meeting somebody who did that outreach out to their school or out to their university, or kind of like we mentioned earlier, it was having and seeing somebody in a role, right? So it became something that they could aspire to and realize that there was a path there. So I really do think that those are very, very important. And just that general encouragement and support and providing those facilities and capability can make things as easily accessible as possible for as many folks as possible. And that was part of what we were trying to do in the work we were doing.
That modeling is really important.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, even for example, when we were doing the pilot work with regard to the Cyber Squad and the program, I used to go into classrooms and troops. My daughter's a Girl Scout, right? And so we were testing out the material and just seeing what people found engaging or not and so on. But anyway, we went through one session. And at the end of it, two of the girls were chatting, and they're about 9-10 years old. And then one of the girls, her younger sister, came into the room and was, hey, what was going on? So they were explaining that I did cybersecurity. And the little girl said, so is she like a security guard? Does she have like a flashlight and she walks around at night checking things out? And my job's never quite been described, but I thought that was funny. But what was really amazing was then listening to the two girls who had just learned all these concepts and ideas, and they turned around and explained to a six-year-old, right, in their own words, what cyberspace was, here were some things you could do, and what my job was. And, you know, it's not often that you get little kids referring to you as cool and what you do being cool, but I had that opportunity. So it really sort of, I guess, solidified for me that it is really important to have role models, but it is important for these things to be sort of tangible for kids to understand sort of what is possible.
It's really great that Scouts is doing this. I mean, I don't know about your sense, but my sense is that this is not generally a part of the curriculum kids are getting in school. I mean, I know my kids in high school have had a sort of POSDEC, positive decisions class that encompasses some cyber security, some cyber hygiene stuff and cyber bullying and so on. But I don't think that that's typical across school districts. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on whether kids are getting this from other avenues if they don't happen to be involved in Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts.
You know, it's hard to answer that. I've seen some instances where I've seen programs around educating kids about cyber and talking about being online and that, but they do appear in some instances to be very specific, right, to certain areas or regions or schools or what have you. And I think It's certainly feedback that we have gotten as we have gone through this is just an overwhelming kind of response and outreach of people who are really interested in this and, you know, want to see what the opportunity is to engage in this way because they don't see a lot of this available and certainly not in this format. We all know that there's information online, but having something that's really engaging that the kids really want to do and love doing. And also in addition to that, I think another component of this that was really important to us was, so as the Girl Scouts are going through this, they are obviously our troop leaders, and it became just as important to us to ensure that the troop leaders and the adults, the parents, had access to sort of the supporting information around what we were teaching online. Mm-hmm. So that education of parents in support of this speaks to us, but I do think there's opportunity to do more because, like we said, the world's really connected. It's a great thing and there's huge benefits, but with it comes some risk. And I don't think any of us see that changing.
You know, we've all seen the data, I think by some measures, you know, less representation of women in computer science than there have been at periods in the past. So the trend lines haven't been going the right direction, but do you think we see these turning around in the next decade or decade and a half and seeing more and more women in not only computer science and cybersecurity, but other technical engineering field?
I think it's an absolute necessity. I do think, you know, there's been a lot more conversation. I do see things taking hold. I also honestly believe that we're part of a technology industry and technology is always known for being agile and working at speed. And I really believe this is one place where we can do a lot in a short time to encourage more women into this field and additionally support those who are in there in some aspect and sort of broaden their horizons. So I do genuinely believe that we can make significant difference in the next 10 years. But I do think we need to remain very focused and continuing to do the sort of work that we're doing and being really committed to us. So I'm very, very hopeful and optimistic. Look, I think there's a really bright future ahead for everybody, but we've got to pull everybody into that, and that's what we're trying to do.
Liz Joyce of Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, thanks so much for coming on and speaking to us on Security Ledger Podcast.
Thanks, Paul. It's great being here.
Elizabeth Joyce is the Chief Information Security Officer of Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. She was here to talk to us about Hewlett-Packard Enterprise's collaboration with the Girl Scouts of America. Up next, the idea behind data leak prevention technology is pretty straightforward. Tag the data that's most important to your organization and then use policies and monitoring tools to keep it from accidentally slipping out of your control. The reality, of course, is more messy, according to our next guest, Vijay Ramanathan of the firm Code 42. For one thing, he points out, very few companies actually understand what data they possess or where it is stored. Beyond that, the job of sorting out what data is important enough to monitor is nearly impossible. For most companies, he argues, all the data they possess is likely to be important in some way. In this conversation, Ramanathan and I talk about how the DLP space is changing and how the job of protecting data leaks is made more difficult by the advent of cloud computing and hybrid environments. I started by asking Vijay to talk a little bit about Code 42 and their technology.
My name is Vijay Ramanathan. I'm SVP of Product Management at Code 42.
Vijay, tell us a little bit about Code 42 and what your company does.
Yeah. Code 42 is next-gen data loss protection. So what we do is we help our customers understand where their data lives, how it moves, and what data is at risk, be it through situations like departing employees and insider threats, or situations where you're just eager to understand whether you have data loss scenarios going on.
You know, one of the challenges is companies have a tremendous amount of data on their networks,
Yes.
In a modern IT environment. Traditionally, the idea was, well, not all that data is equal. Some of it you want to protect, and some of it doesn't matter. You don't need to spend money, certainly, to protect it.
Right.
You
really take issue with that. Talk about why.
Yes, we do take issue with that because if we think about the information that we create and work on, right, in as part of any organization, there's almost nothing we do that doesn't matter. Right? Everything we do matters at some level. You know, the traditional approach has always been, well, not everything matters. There's probably going to be, you know, X percentage of stuff that you really care about and Y percentage that you don't care about. And then that begs the question, why are you even working on it? And the reason traditionally that has always held up as an argument, because the notion of important data had always been predominantly through perspectives like compliance, regulatory needs. So if it's got customer data, I care about it. If it's got employee data, I care about it. Well, that model has changed or has evolved, I would say, to say, well, there's a lot of sensitive data that aren't necessarily categorized as those types of data. Intellectual property, for example, or other types of sensitive corporate information that can't really be tagged using the traditional notions of importance and non-importance. So rather than trying to go down a path of saying, well, you just have to get better at classifying, you just have to get better at policy creation, which is the fool's errand because you'll never get to the end game there, is to say, well, let's just flip the conversation on its head. Why don't you just assume everything matters? Just start collecting everything, and then over time, and as you gain sophistication, you might learn something for it. But even right off the gate, if something starts going off the rails, you are so much more prepared to respond to that because you didn't have to think about that thing going off the rails before. The fact that it went off the rails, you can still have the peace of mind going, oh, I can still find out what happened. A classic example that we use is a departing employee scenario, right? Very common DLP case. Someone puts in their 2-week notice or expand the policy or move them to the right policy so that you prevent them from copying stuff, et cetera, et cetera. Great. Well, what have they been doing for the last 60 days? And how much visibility do you have into that? That's where we say, we're always monitored. We're always collecting. Mm-hmm. We have the files. We can tell you what links they shared. And you didn't have to know that they were going to quit. So that to me is, you know, why I approach, you know, prevention as a very limited time frame opportunity. And you really have to think about data security in a much more holistic fashion. No more different than how you think of security in your day-to-day life. You know, if I go back to my home example, you don't just put a door and a lock on it. You do, of course you do. But then you do other things. You do invest in, you know, your Nest cams and your Ring cams. And oh, by the way, you have insurance. Mm-hmm. So if something really goes wrong, you can get back on your feet. Why shouldn't we take that approach with data?
Right. Well, you bring up a really interesting point, which is in some ways this conversation started with compliance, right? It started with regulations like PCI and HIPAA, where not all data was equal, right? So there
Correct.
Was the covered data and there was not covered data.
Absolutely.
And so these solutions in some ways came about to address that problem, but now the problem is very different. Compliance is a problem, yes,
still a problem,
of course,
yes,
but it's probably not the main focus of organizations, I'm guessing.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that has been the history of DLP products is compliance. But as you know, if you look at the Verizon data risk report that they published yesterday, what's the headline? Insider threat, right?
Yep.
It's not, you know, it's not HIPAA, it's not GDPR. I mean, those are still important to your point, but the headlines are changing, right? So the things that people worry about are things that are not data elements that fit into the traditional model of data security.
Right.
And so it almost requires you to think orthogonally about the problem, right? Don't think in terms of policy lists and frameworks, think in terms of the landscape.
Right.
And where might risk exist? One of the other analogies I like to use is, you know, if smartphones and you were around in the early 2000s and your idea of the best smartphone was a BlackBerry with a keyboard, and when someone says, hey, you know, here's, you know, there should be a smartphone with no keyboard and it should be full screen, and you'd be like, I'm never going to buy that phone. Man, how am I going to get that touch response and this thing? This would be a terrible smartphone.
Sure. You heard those arguments.
Right?
Yeah,
you did.
Like the tactile.
And then, the tactile response. And then here comes along Apple, right? And they say, here's this really cool phone. Yeah, it doesn't do all the things your BlackBerry did.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as feature rich, but just look at what it lets you do that you couldn't do before.
Right.
And then suddenly the world's flipped on its head.
Right.
So, or you could do the same analogy with, you know, the internet in circa 1995 was Yahoo directories.
Right.
And then search comes along and Google changes it all on its head. You don't have to have, directory is a great example. You had to know how to classify websites to know how to find them.
Right.
And then Google says, you don't have to classify, just search for them and find them. That's what we do.
Right.
So you have to almost take a disruptor, you know, orthogonal approach to the problem. Otherwise, you don't carve out the future of data security.
Tell us a little bit about how Code 42 does this. It's a new approach to doing data leak monitoring or data leak protection. How does it work?
Yeah, we fundamentally take a, you know, a zero trust approach, right? So as I said, why not assume everything matters? And so the way we do it is we look at data wherever it lives and how it moves. This includes cloud, so your Google Drive instance, your OneDrive instance, as well as your non-cloud data sources, which are predominantly your employee computers, right? Your endpoints. So the way we do it is we have technology that we've built that, and Code42's offering is a cloud-based offering. So we've built technology that connects to those cloud data sources via API, and it collects data on every file event. And what I mean by an event is every creation, every modification, every deletion. In the case of cloud, it's link sharing, who creates what links, at what time, who's that link shared with. And we collect all the data near real time, along with data from all the other employee computers, again, and there on the employee computers, we're looking at the context of the data. So not just creation, modification, deletion, but what's moving to thumb drives, what's getting uploaded to browsers, what's getting what's getting touched by FTP.
So not just network, but endpoint as well.
Yeah, endpoint as well, yeah. So, and in fact, we don't do anything specifically on the network. All the data that we capture around file movement is from the endpoint or the cloud-to-cloud perspective, right? And so when you collect all of this, and then what we do is we move that data near real-time to our, you know, to our cloud, where it's indexed within minutes of the file event happening. So very quickly, you have almost, and our interface to this is very simple. It's very Google-like. You just go in and say, help me understand what this person was doing from, you know, February 1st to February 27th. And it'll tell you, and maybe you only want to know what they copied to thumb drives. Here's the list. Here's everything they did.
Right.
And then what's interesting about us is then all that same data is not just searchable through us, it's accessible through our APIs. So if you are someone who's using orchestration products or you're using a SIM, you know, Splunk, whatever, that data is immediately accessible to you.
So you can start getting, creating alerts, creating events around data.
Data movement. Yeah. Right. So sensitive data, like a great example for us, I gave you one example earlier about departing employees, right? So a standard way our customers would approach it is to, you know, when someone does go on a 2-week, puts in a 2-week notice, they have a workflow that automatically, you know, investigates their movement in the last 30 days.
Right.
You know, what have they been copying, uploading, downloading, all that kind of jazz.
Right.
And then there are, there might be different steps that they do in the case of, for instance, involuntary termination. Right,
yes.
They might have a different workflow.
Right.
Another great example that, you know, kind of like a playbook that we're looking at that are some of our customers are using us for is mergers and acquisitions. So you have a lot of IP coming in, but you have sensitivity with the employees who might stay, not stay. What are they sharing with whom? What are they are they copying to thumb drives? So that data movement really becomes the critical thing that we do. And yeah, so all that's built into the platform, and it's all centered around, you know, how data is moving. The last thing I'll mention, which is different that we do, it's almost unique in what we do compared to every other DLP vendor, is we keep a copy of the file, of every file on every employee computer.
Okay.
So as broad or narrow as you as a customer would like it to be. So for, in our case, we have customers who'd say, you know, let's just use Windows as an example. They might say, I want everything on C:/ except DLLs or plist files or something like that, right? Fine. We'll collect everything, you know, and then they can decide how long they want it kept for. A year? 6 months? Forever?
Okay.
Do you want to keep deleted files? Sure, we'll keep deleted files.
Okay.
And then what that helps our customers then do is like, so suppose they're in an analysis state and the machine in question or the person in question is not online or is no longer with the company or whatever. The data is still there. You never lose the data. Right, so you can always look at the file and decide, did they try to mask employee ID numbers?
Yes.
You can visually inspect the file.
Fascinating.
Right? Yeah. So that is something we do, and we let our customers have, you know, do that as broadly as they want.
Huh.
Right? And almost no one else does that. And so that kind of sets us apart because we, and that's why we get away with saying zero trust. Everything matters. We keep a copy of everything, and when you're worried about something, we show you the file.
Now, I'm sure you have come, obviously, many of your customers have tons of sensitive data and so on.
Yeah.
How does it work then with them, with you guys maintaining copies of this data on your own infrastructure? How does that relationship work?
Yeah, no, great question. So for the copies of files that we do keep in our infrastructure, every file is encrypted before it leaves the endpoint. Right, and it's encrypted, unique to the user. Mm-hmm. So if we have a customer with 1,000 employees, mm-hmm. let's say they have 1,000 laptops, mm-hmm. right, as an example, and we're collecting all the files from those computers, we have 1,000 different encryption keys each per user, and that data never unencrypted data never lands on our infrastructure.
Okay.
So we cannot really look at that data.
Okay.
The metadata, on the other hand, which is what we have to make searchable,
right,
of course, shows up on our metadata store, and we run it through our indexer process and we make it searchable. But the actual data is totally locked.
Okay.
Now, the customer themselves and their admin, when they want to do an investigation, they can go retrieve the file and we can then let them, you know, decrypt it and see it.
Okay.
That's how that works.
Okay. One of the features historically of DLP solutions mm-hmm. is that, you know, you have this data that you're protecting. And then, of course, you've got to create a whole bunch of policies to manage that data.
Right.
So now that you know what the data is, you've got to figure out how it is you want it shared, not shared, used, not used. You pointed out that that's, first of all, a huge overhead for companies and also pretty brittle.
Correct.
So how does it work with Code 40?
Yeah. No, great question. So we have some core convictions about the product, right? And one of the first things we say is, A, no blocking. Two, no required policies in order to use a product.
Okay.
Right? Three, cloud and non-cloud. Mm-hmm. And four, every file matters.
Mm-hmm.
Those are our four convictions, right? So let's talk about the first two because those are relevant to your question. So traditional approaches have always been about knowing what data matters to you and setting up policies that then say, as you rightly pointed out, what should move, what should not move, what should, you know, what can be attached to an email and not, so on and so forth. What we say is all that's, you know, going to go away. So we come in and say, let's just look at everything. And when we look at everything, let's just collect as much context as we can about that data element at that time.
Right.
So as an example, let's just take an example of files sitting on your computer, right? And one of the things we can do is we can just start, as we index that data, we can just start saying, okay, what are the actual file types of that data? Oh, they're documents, they're spreadsheets, they're PDFs, right? Simple enough.
Sure.
You don't have to write any policies for that, right? We do that.
Yep.
But then here's where we go ahead. We say, okay, of those files that we looked at, how many of them actually have a mismatch with the extension? An example, it's something.mp3, but the MIME typesets, it's a PDF.
Mm.
Well, that's risk,
mm-hmm.
right? And so we can automatically show that to our security analyst, you know, to the customer security analysts, and say, well, this person you've been monitoring for the last, who you know is departing in the last 30 days has had, you know, 50 files where there's a file type mismatch. Do you want to investigate it?
Mm-hmm.
And they can go, yeah, sure. Well, here's our advantage. We have those 50 files.
Right.
And we can show it to them. They can be like, yeah, those aren't MP3s.
Right.
Those are PDFs. Those are documents. And why is that person trying to mask or cloak the files?
Right.
Another great example are zip files. A lot of people, you know, traditional ways of bypassing DLP have always been involved, you know, create a zip, encrypt it, and email it.
Pretty straightforward.
Well, we can just tell you all the people who've been creating large zip files in the last 24 hours.
Right.
And oh, by the way, which have been touched by Chrome.exe
mm-hmm.
or Slack.exe
mm-hmm.
or FTP.exe.
Interesting.
And you can be like, that sounds odd. Why are people doing that? Right? So for us,
which would speak to the exfiltration.
Exfiltration. Right. Yeah, exactly. So a big issue that, you know, we see in the traditional approach is it just encourages people to look for other ways. Not always malicious, mind you.
Yes, right.
They're just, and this goes to our second conviction of no blocking. Because we have to work in an environment, especially with a changing workforce and people who like to get stuff done fast using the tools that they like to,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether you call them millennial or Gen X or Gen Y or whatever. I don't really care, right? We all want to get our job done fast. Young people, right?
AKA and, young people.
And all of us, for that matter, just would like to be as efficient as possible. Sure. That's why we do the things we do. Yeah. So why put roadblocks in their way? Uh-huh. Let's assume they're doing the good job, and we're just there to make sure that the guardrails are in place, and if something goes sideways, and if something looks out of whack, I can just look at it, and I can be like, did you mean to do that?
Right.
Like, did you really do that? Oh, yeah, in that case, that was one of our training engineers who was, sharing VMs with, the foreign location where they're going to actually do the training. Oh, right. That's fine.
Right, right.
That's what you need security to be. Right. You don't need security to be the cop who stops you from doing bad things, right? So for us, that's the philosophy that drives DLP. That is, I think, has been the traditional downfall of DLP, right? It's just that the intent has never been bad. Right? The intent of DLP has never been bad.
Right.
It's how you approach the problem that has always faltered. And so then people start doing these weird things like, trying to circumvent, the policy engine that they know will stop them from doing the job.
Right.
And then you have unknown unknowns. You can go find out if I don't know it today, as opposed to like, I don't even know what I don't know.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where we say is a marked difference between traditional DLP and next-gen DLP is, we can tell, even if you didn't think about it before, once you think about it, we can tell you everything about it.
Right. You guys get a really interesting view of, customer data flows, mm-hmm. obviously.
Yeah.
And then also of threats and incidents. So I think, we're here at the RSA conference. There's a certain narrative about advanced persistent threat and nation state actors. It's all very stealthy and scary. But
what
do you guys see really out there in the trenches in terms of what is the real risks and challenges that organizations are facing regarding retaining sensitive data, losing track of sensitive data?
Yeah, great question. So at the macro level, so the first thing I will say is, yes, we do see a lot of customer usage, but the way we see it is fairly anonymized, right?
Yeah.
So we don't know what one specific customer is, problems they're facing or not. But we know enough to tell you, at a macro level, the continued persistent problems at any company still, insofar as data is concerned, is they say, we don't know where our data is. Where does data live?
Yeah.
How is that data leaving? When is it leaving? And most importantly, what is leaving, right? So all of those continue to be persistent problems. And the reason I can say that is, when we look at the type of problems our customers try to solve using our technology, let me give you an example, right? So mergers and acquisitions, I mentioned before. So we have a customer who's in the manufacturing space, and they acquired a company. And part of what they have to do is they don't have the time as a manufacturing company, nor do they have the IT and security staff to do this, full-fledged, merger of platforms and all that. So all they do is, okay, we're a OneDrive shop, you're a Google shop. We're still acquiring. You're going to use what you're going to use. I'm going to use what I'm going to use till we figure out how to rationalize this, right? And in that time frame, they just use us to figure out what sensitive data do they have that they're still either deleting or not deleting, mm-hmm. right? All mm-hmm. of that stuff. And they have immediate visibility. One of our customers was very quickly able to find in one of those scenarios a company out of Asia that they had been, that acquired, and there were employees sitting in Asia. But because of export restrictions, not all Asian employees were supposed to have data that's supposed to be resident in the U.S.
Right.
But using our product and just by doing file hash searches, they were able to find employees in the Asia office have a whole set of files that they weren't supposed to have, right? It's those kinds of scenarios that are becoming a lot more prevalent now.
So you were kind of the point of the spear on the IT consolidation.
Exactly. So, to your original question, yes, it is about, at some level, state actors and persistent threats and all that, but there's a whole real bread and butter set of problems that people are dealing with in companies that are just trying to do good work. You can think of ATPs or APTs and state actors as first world problems. There are third world problems people are trying to solve.
Sure.
Right? And that's where we really help, kind of reduce the clutter.
And you bring up a great example too, which is, with GDPR and a lot of mm-hmm. these, national data privacy laws, you are ending up with this kind of balkanization of data, right?
The more tools you have at your disposal to quickly understand what's where, the more prepared you are to respond to that audit. That's all that matters.
Vijay Ramanathan, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us on Security Ledger Podcast.
Thank you so much.
Vijay Ramanathan is a senior vice president at the firm Code 42. He was here to talk with us about data leak prevention. You've been listening to the Security Ledger podcast. This week's podcast was brought to you by Code 42. Today's progressive, employee-focused, idea-rich organizations are looking for new and less restrictive ways to protect their data. Code 42 Next-Gen Data Loss Protection is a simpler, quicker way to secure an organization's endpoint and cloud data from loss, leak, misuse, and theft. You can check them out at code42.com. That's code, and then the numbers 42.com.